Well, would you turn with me to the book of Ecclesiastes? We're going to be starting a new series this evening. If you remember, we just finished last week the book of Esther, and so today we're going to be starting the book of Ecclesiastes, and if you need help getting there, it's Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes. So if you just get in the middle of the Old Testament, you'll pretty much find Psalms and then just move a couple books over. So what's interesting about the book of Ecclesiastes is it's a part of the Bible's wisdom literature. Maybe some of you have heard this before. Throughout the Bible, there's different categories to kind of categorize certain books. So you'll have some historical books, right? So like Esther, that would be a historical book, right? It's going through a narrative of something that actually happened in history. You can think of like the book of Acts, that would be a historical book. You have books that are more like epistles, like Paul's letters. You have the Psalms, which is really it's almost its own category. And then you have the wisdom literature, and that would include books like Job, which really addresses suffering in the world. You have Proverbs, which talks about just proper wisdom in general, how you are to live your daily life. And typically, if you do wise things, if you make wise choices, then good usually follows. That's kind of what Proverbs focuses in on. And then the Song of Solomon, which focuses a lot about love, and it's actually really unique in the way that the book of Song of Solomon is written. So Ecclesiastes is one of those books in the wisdom literature, and so what that means is it's trying to teach us some principles to actually put into practice. So this is actually to make take active steps in applying this message to our own daily lives. It's teaching us to live well, essentially. It's trying to help us live well. And so when we look at verse 1 of the book, so chapter 1, verse 1, we see here that these are the words of the preacher, is basically what it says. So the author is referred to here as the preacher. Now, that word preacher in the Hebrew, or in Hebrew, is koheleth, koheleth. And what that actually means is one who addresses the assembly. So that's actually what that word means, that we get preacher. So one who addresses the assembly, or one who brings and gathers the assembly. And if many of you are probably familiar, the word assembly or gathering in the New Testament is ecclesia, right? So that's actually where we get the word for church, ecclesia, right? And so now when we think about the book of Ecclesiastes, that's actually where we get that name. So it's actually coming from this word of koheleth, which is the word that we see here for preacher. Some translations might say teacher, or it might say speaker, or it might even just say koheleth, right? It might even just use that Hebrew name. So there's different ways that translations will use that name there. But I think preacher is a helpful way to think of it, because what's happening here is this author is gathering an assembly for the purpose of instructing them in righteousness, in godly wisdom, right? So, and we can think of this speaker as the preacher. And really, like I said, that's basically what the book Ecclesiastes means. It's the preacher gathering the assembly, speaking to the assembly. And so who is this preacher? Well, in verse 1, if you see, it says the words of the preacher, and then it says the son of David, king in Jerusalem. So what majority of scholars through tradition have held is that the author, or who the preacher is actually King Solomon. That would be David's son who became king after David passed away, right? We know that Solomon took the throne. And so many view it to be Solomon himself as the author of this book. There are some others that are more of the minority view that hold that, no, this is just another king that that also served, and he's just saying he is a son of David in the sense that there's a lineage, a connection here. And there's some that also say that, no, this was written way later after Solomon has been dead, and this isn't even a king. This is actually just a religious scribe who is writing, and he's taking the persona of Solomon. So he's taking the life lessons of Solomon and teaching this as if he were Solomon. And this is actually something that would be done rather frequently in the ancient world, where people would take on a teaching of someone's life previously. However, I think that if we just take the words as they are, I think the best, in, as I said, with what tradition seems to hold, is that it most likely is probably going to be David's nearest son, Solomon, who's the king in Jerusalem. And also, I think there's one other verse that kind of hints at this as well. In verse, or chapter 1, verse 16, it says this. It says, I communed with my heart, saying, look, I have attained greatness and have gained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. My heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge. Now, many of us probably are familiar with, right? What is the thing that Solomon asks God for? It's wisdom, right? And we see that Solomon ends up being well-renowned, you know, famous for how wise he actually is as a king. And throughout history, he's been viewed as like the wisest king or even like the wisest person in the Old Testament, right? Right? So he's credited for his wisdom. And in fact, we know he wrote the Song of Solomon, most likely at least. And we know that he wrote majority of Proverbs and he wrote some of the Psalms. Right. So we see here that he is a man of wisdom. And I think that it's helpful for us to think of it most likely as Solomon, or at least his story. And what's interesting, if this is written by Solomon, is that if you know his story, he started out really, really good, right? He asked God for wisdom. God granted him wisdom, right? He was gracious with giving Solomon all of this wisdom. And he became basically one of the most successful kings, like, of all time in Israel's history. But we saw that after he got really successful, he got comfortable, became complacent spiritually, and he started to marry lots of other pagan women and adding wives, which he was forbidden to do. He started adding these women to his kingdom. And what these women did is they led him after other gods, right? And so a lot of these women that had pagan worship practices, he actually ended up following these women into these other worship practices. So he creates idols. He starts to do worship to these other gods. And it just causes a lot of trouble for Solomon. And so at the end of his story, we don't really see a positive picture for Solomon. If you will see the end, it almost looks like, well, he doesn't even look like a believer at this point, right? He looks like someone who did great. Now he's basically at the point where he looks like just as bad as any bad king that you can possibly think of, right? So you have him at the end there, and so some think, well, what happened to Solomon? Did he just die as an apostate? Well, if Ecclesiastes is written by Solomon, and most view this to be the latest of his writings, this would actually be a indication that he repented near the end of his life, after he's been reflecting on his prodigal living, after he's learned the pursuit of this world, thinking about wealth, thinking about career, pleasure, wisdom even, all of these different pursuits under the sun. And then what he does here is he writes this book as a life lesson. And so what he's doing is he's saying, here are the mistakes that I committed in my life. Learn from my mistakes. You don't have to learn them for yourself. I've already done this. And I'm telling you, it's not worth it. So I think that that's actually a helpful way, is to think, this is Solomon in all of his wisdom, in all of his experience, saying, this is what I did in my life. Learn from me. And so I think that that might be a helpful way to kind of, kind of just preview this book. So that being said, what I want to do tonight is we're going to read verses 1 to 11 of the first chapter. We're not going to finish the chapter this evening, but just read verses 1 to 11. So hopefully you've all turned there with me. It says, the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What profit has a man from all his labor, in which he toils under the sun? One generation passes away, and another generation comes, but the earth abides forever. The sun also rises, and the sun goes down, and hastens to the place where it arose. The wind goes toward the south and turns around to the north. The wind whirls about continually and comes again on its circuit. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full, to the place from which the rivers come. There they return again. All things are full of labor. Man cannot express it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. That which has been is what will be. That which is done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which it may be said, see, this is new? It has already been in ancient times before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of things that are to come by those who will come after. So we see here, in the very, you know, after verse 1, we see the introduction of who the author is, or who the preacher is, right? We then go right into verse 2, and we see how it's different from a lot of other books, right? This actually is probably one of the gloomier books, especially this introduction, right? You can't think of probably a more, like, gloomy introduction to a book as saying, "Vanity of vanities," says the preacher, "vanity of vanities, all is vanity." So he's literally saying everything, all is vanity. And so what I think right out of the gate when he's teaching us this message, this is actually going to be the theme throughout the book, is he's saying all is vanity. It's going to show us that Ecclesiastes is for the more mature reader, whereas Proverbs is going to be teaching you, like I said, the more simplistic basics of proper wisdom, where you do this thing and usually good follows. What he's going to show here in this book is that actually sometimes there are just bad things that happen. Sometimes life isn't fair. Sometimes you can be wise and still the young can die, or, you know, the wise can die young, and the corrupt can live to a ripe old age. And so he's going to show that, you know, there's actually bad things that can happen. And sometimes it's not as cut and dry as maybe Proverbs. Not that they're saying that Proverbs is wrong, but just making it more complete in its understanding of what wisdom looks like in this world. And so he's starting this by saying all is vanity. Now, the word vanity is in the Hebrew, it's hevel, right? So some of your translations might say meaningless. And that's not completely off if your translation might say meaningless, but I think it's actually a little bit more specific than that. I think that there's definitely an allusion to this this thought of it's meaningless. But really what hevel means is it means vapor or breath. Or like smoke, right? So just think of something like that. If you were to blow out a candle and you see that light smoke just in the air for a moment, right? Or on a cold day where you just breathe and you can see the breath kind of just go and then it dissipates, right? That's kind of what hevel is. That's what the actual word itself means. And this word is so important that we get this right, because in the book it's used 38 times, right? So for a book with only 12 chapters, it's used 38 times, and he's using it right here. I think what we see it 5 times in the second verse, right? So this is something that we definitely want to get right. So what he's talking about, all is hevel, or all is like vapor, or life is like a breath, or is like smoke. And this is similar to what some of the psalmists. So hevel in the Hebrew, well, when you translate it from Hebrew, it's actually H-E-B-E-L, but it's pronounced hevel with a V rather than the B. I don't know. H-E-B-E-L. Yes. But then you can also write it H-E-V-E-L if you want to throw the V in there just for the pronunciation. So hevel or hevel, right? So we see that this is the word that he's using, and the psalmists use this verse, or use this word in a similar fashion. It says in Psalm 39, verses 5 and 6, "Indeed, you have made my days as handbreadths, and my age is as nothing before you. Certainly, every man at his best state is but vapor, or is hevel. Surely, every man walks about like a shadow. Surely, they busy themselves in vain. He heaps up riches and does not know who will gather them." So here, this is the psalmist saying that in my ages, that's nothing before you, that is before God. And then certainly every man at his best, at his very best state, is still nothing but vapor, nothing but hevel. It's just a moment, a breath, right? So that's what the psalmist says in Psalm 39. And then likewise, we see not the word hevel, but the same principle or the same thought process in Psalm 103. Verses 15 and 16, where it says, "As for man, his days are like grass, as a flower of the field. So he flourishes, for the wind passes over it, and it is gone, and its place remembers it no more." So you see this fleeting, quick, short, brief nature of what it means to be human under the sun. That's kind of the point that this author is getting at. He's saying that life is, it's short, life is elusive, and oftentimes, as we'll see in this section, life can also be repetitive. So, like I said, doesn't start out very positive. He's saying life is short, it's elusive, and it's repetitive. And what he's saying then, when we're trying to grasp at these different things in life, when it comes to wealth, when it comes to wisdom, when it comes to pleasure, these different things, he says that life is like trying to grasp in terms of these things, and what we'll find is it's like looking for something that has no significance or no ultimate fulfillment. And so another way to think of it, and it's actually used later in this book, is it's like chasing after the wind, right? You know how it's futile, right? If you're chasing after the wind, you're never going to get it. Or another way to think of it is my son loves bubbles lately, right? So you blow bubbles and you'll see his face light up. But as you know, when he tries to go and he sees the bubble and he's watching it float down, he's just waiting finally to get it. And as soon as it gets there, he grabs onto it, he grasps it, and what happens? It's gone, right? That's the point. That's kind of what he's saying here. He says that's what life is. You can try to grasp onto these things, trying to find fulfillment, trying to find meaning, trying to be, you know, satisfied. But as soon as you try to grab onto it, it's gone. And so that's kind of what he's saying when he's saying that these things are hevel. So the message is going to be that the pursuit of power, of popularity, of prestige, and pleasure, they are all ultimately empty. They're futile. And in fact, that's what we are taught in Romans 8:20, where we're taught about not only the brevity of life, but the futility of human endeavors. In Romans 8:20, it says, "For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it in hope." So what this is a reminder for us is this hevel, right? This futility that we are experiencing in this world, right? Where it feels so short and elusive and repetitive. When we feel burdened by the hevel of life, it's a reminder that this is what happened at the fall. When man fell and sinned, this is what the earth became. It experiences this monotony, right? This ongoing cycle of life that can be actually kind of upsetting or depressing even sometimes if you were to read it and to think about it. And so that's why in then verse 3, which this is a pivotal verse and question, in verse 3, we see this question where he says, "What profit has a man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun?" So he's saying all of this, right? We just said it's all vanity. And then so the question is, so what does it profit a man if he toils and labors and works so hard, passionately for all of these different things? And the implication that we're going to see through not only this chapter, but through the book is the implication is there is no profit. The answer is nothing, right? Which, like I said, that doesn't sound very encouraging. He's saying the answer here is nothing. And when you say profit, what it's talking about here is with all the wealth, like so let's say you work your whole life for wealth, right? And then at the end of the day, when you die, what do you get to do? What does it profit you with that wealth? And what he's going to say is, you don't get it, right? So the answer is going to be nothing. That's the point that he's going to start pursuing here in this book. So in verses 4-8 then, what we see after he describes all being vanity, he asks the question, now he's going to start breaking it down and giving, though he doesn't say just the answer is nothing, he basically is going to give these long responses to kind of teach that and show that really for us. So what we see then in verses 4-8 is he starts to talk about how life is a perpetual cycle. We're basically all just like on a treadmill or a hamster wheel where we just keep going, and it's just a repetitive nature. And so in verse 4, what we see is at first it describes the generations, right? So we see the cycle of generations. It says one generation passes away, and then another generation comes, but the earth abides forever. Like I said, there is some hope in this book. I hope you see that as it comes. But, you know, he gets darker here for a second. He's like, so basically you're a generation, and there's a generation that was ahead of you, that they're gone, and then there's a generation that's coming up behind you, and they're going to take your place. And the thing is, and then they're going to be gone. But here's the thing, the earth, it's just going to keep on going, you know? The same sun that was rising and setting with your great-great-great-grandparents is the same one that your great-great-great-grandchildren are also going to be seeing. The tide is going to be going in and out, when we're here and when we're gone. And so that's kind of the point that he's saying, but it's just this ongoing cycle of generations. And then in verses 5 to 7, he says, but this is really the whole pattern of nature. We see that there's these repetitive patterns of nature in verses 5 to 7. It says, the sun also rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it arose. The wind goes toward the south and turns around to the north. The wind whirls about continually and comes again on its circuit. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full, to the place from which the rivers come. There they return again. So in verses 5 to 7, it mentions three different things. It mentions the sun, it mentions the wind, and then it mentions these waters or rivers that are running into the sea, right? So you have sun, wind, and water, right? So these are three pretty common elements that would be addressed, right? You have that'd be the fire, the wind, and the water. And so what he's saying here is first he addresses the sun. And what is the repetitive nature of the sun? Well, I kind of already mentioned it, right? It goes, right, around. Now, obviously, we know technically the earth goes around, but for this poetic way that he's describing it, we see, from our perspective, the sun rising and setting, right? It just keeps doing it. And the way that he actually describes it here, and if you have my version, you don't maybe get the full weight of it, but it says it hastens to the place. I think a more helpful, a better translation of that word is it pants. It's like describing the sun as like this tedious task of it's constantly running. It's trying to catch its breath as it's regularly doing the same thing over and over again for thousands or millions or billions of years, right? So it just keeps on going. It's hastening or it's panting as it goes to its place. And then likewise, it goes to the wind. And I think that this is a poetic way of saying we have the sun going east and west, right? And then we have the wind being described as going north and south. So it's trying to just show the whole circle of the earth, right? It's covering all sides of the earth. And it's saying that likewise, the wind goes really hard one way and then it's going back the other way. It's like, what's the point? You just went that way. Now you're going back that way. And then it's just this ongoing circuit. Like, so we see this cycle of not only the sun, but we see it with the wind. And then I really like the way that it describes the rivers now. Then it says the rivers, they're continuously running into the sea or to the ocean, right? So they're filling the ocean. And they've been doing that forever, right? Before us, right? And the thing is, it describes the sea or the ocean as never being filled. Right? It never stops. And we know, like, obviously with the water cycle, right? There's another cycle. We know that the water cycle keeps it to where it never fully fills. But then what he does is he transitions from verse 7 into verse 8 and explains how that really resonates with us as humans. Just like how the sea is regularly being filled and filled and filled, it's never really full. It's never really satisfied. And so in verse 8, what we see then is it's a description of the human experience basically being the same way as we see the patterns of nature. In verse 8, it says, all things are full of labor. Man cannot express it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. So what we're saying here in verse 8, it says full of labor. So the one thing that it's full of is labor. So it's not full of good things, right? It's full of labor. And actually that word right there, you can look at the Hebrew. A better word I think for that is weariness. So the one thing that you're going to be full of in this ongoing cycle, this ongoing pattern in life is weariness, is basically what he's saying here. And then so then he supports it by saying some specific senses that we have. He's saying that we all have these senses, right? You have the two he uses here is he has seeing and hearing. And what he says is, when you think about our senses of seeing and hearing, though they're regularly taking in things, they're never really full. They're never really satisfied. Now just think about that for a second. So think about our senses and how on this side of eternity, they're never really satisfied, right? I mean, how many of you watched a good movie before? I'm sure many of us, right? How many have seen a TV show that they loved? Right? Who has seen a beautiful sunset or a beautiful landscape or scenery or animal, right? We've all seen these wonderful, beautiful things, right? But as soon as we've done it, we're not satisfied. We don't say, okay, I'm ready to go blind, do we? We want to see the next thing, don't we? And the next thing. I know that when we go on vacation, we get really excited for our vacation. We just had one recently. We had some sickness, so that was a little upsetting. But we look forward to a summer vacation, right? And so we plan, we look forward to it, we get there, but then after the vacation's over, we didn't say, well, we saw everything we need to see. We say, no, what's the next thing we need to go do and see and experience, right? Or I know me and my wife, we'll watch a TV series and we get so excited when we find one that actually has a long amount of seasons so we can stay there for a while because it's so hard to find one that's better and pure and, you know, appropriate or somewhat appropriate, right? And so, but the thing is, after you get through those 9 seasons and it's over, and I think about it sometimes, there's certain seasons I've watched years ago and I'm like, I don't remember really anything about that show. But every single day we were coming back to be filled, 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 and now it's over, and then what's the next thing? What's the next show? And I think that that's what we do in our lives. Same thing with hearing or tasting. I'm sure many of you have had a delicious meal before, but I'm sure many of us are going to go and say we're hungry again. And not just are we going to fill our bellies, but we want to taste something delicious again. Or even if it was delicious and you had seafood or steak or chicken, I'm ready to have that again, right? We're just never satisfied. That's kind of the point he's saying here. He says, your eyes are not satisfied and your ears, though they're constantly hearing stuff, right? You're hearing my voice right now. Even though you might get bored with me talking, your ears aren't full, right? You can continue to hear something. You might even immediately when you leave, get on the radio or call someone on the phone or get on, you know, social media, and you're going to be listening and reading things, right? We just constantly are wanting to fill our ears, our eyes, our minds. We're constantly trying to do it. But what he's saying, being in this cycle, you're never going to be filled. That's the point he's making. Though we're on this cycle, you're never going to be filled. Just like the sea, you'll never actually be to that ending point. And so then in verses 9 to 11, what he describes is the reason for this is because there is nothing new under the sun. And just like Hevel, that's an important phrase, under the sun. You're going to see that happening and quoted many times through this book. So what he's saying is that there is nothing new under the sun. In verse 9, it says this: that which has been is what will be, that which is done is what will be done, and there is nothing new under the sun. So he's basically saying that everything's already basically been done. Everything's already happened here. So we then think and hear that verse, and it reminds us then that there's this illusion in our world of progressing, right? Right? There's the illusion of progression, like we're moving forward here. We got this new thing. We accomplished this, right? And so what he's saying here is like, though we as humans, we are seeking, right? We're seeking fulfillment and trying to find novel things or novel ideas, or maybe we're getting caught up with worldly trends, right, that we think are new. He's saying ultimately, really, you're pursuing new things, and it's vanity. It's in vain. It's futile because there's nothing really new. And it actually reminds me of what we see in Acts 17 by the Athenians. In Acts 17, 21, it says this: for all the Athenians and the foreigners who were there spent their time in nothing else but either to tell or to hear some new thing. That's all they did. They just always were looking for the newest thing, right? They want to hear the newest concept, the newest teaching, the newest fad of the day. And so likewise, we try to do that. And we have this concept of new or novelty that we bring up. We want to know what's the newest thing going on in the news and in politics, right? What's the basketball teams doing today? What's the new thing, right? What's the new iPhone or smartphone? What's the new technological device, right? We're using this concept of new. But what he's saying is, despite humanity's pursuit of progress, really nothing is new. Now you might be asking me now, as I've said this a few times, nothing is new. Well, wait, I think I see new things all the time, right? Like, you know, you could think, well, we have an iPhone now, and at one point we didn't even have a cell phone, right? You might think to yourself, well, wait, we got to the moon, right? Nobody had been to the moon before that we know of, right? So that was new. So what I think the author is saying here is not that there is no technological advancement per se, or that we can't accomplish something here on the earth. But what he's saying is, when you really look at the core of what is happening there, it's really just the same thing through a different medium. So the example of the moon landing, right? What that is, it's just someone is being adventurous. And people have always been adventurous. And when we get to the moon, that's cool for us, right? But really, what happens once we conquer the moon? What's the next goal? I hear a lot of people talking about Mars, right? Or Venus. And the thing is, let's say we conquer the whole solar, or let's say we conquer the Milky Way. What's the next goal for humanity? We're not finished, right? The next goal is, let's get the rest of the universe, right? See, yeah, go through the black hole. We want to see what happens there, right? The thing is, like, it's the sense of adventure. And he's saying that that's not new. People have always been seeking adventure, and we've just doing it on different levels and different mediums, different ways, but Really, it's the same thing. People are pursuing that. What about like technology? Well, most of us know technology is primarily for like communication of some sort, right? Through different mediums, different ways, but it's communicating. But we know there's always been different forms and ways of communication, right? Our socialization. So really, what he's saying is all of these things, though they might look or feel a little different, really, it's still part of that cycle. And it's not going to change or get us out of that cycle. It's really just nothing new is under the sun. And then what he goes on in verses 10 to 11 then to explain is that there's this forgetfulness that we as humans have of history. So like that's what I'm saying is we say that this thing's new or claim that it's new, but really, if we really were to think about like the pioneers before us and we think about what they've done, we recognize, no, this has been a constant pattern. So verses 10 to 11, it says, is there anything of which may be said, see, this is new? It has already been in ancient times before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of things that are to come by those who will come after. So that's what he's basically saying. He said, generally speaking, we forget what happened before us, and then we try to claim that these things are new, but really it's all a part of the same cycle. There's nothing new under the sun. But ultimately, the thing that we all know for certain will occur for us is that we're going to die, and then we're going to be forgotten. Now, isn't that encouraging? Wait, what if I just ended the message right there, right? Right? We're all going to die. Generally speaking, we're all going to die and be forgotten, right? Just like the generations before, just like these people who have done something, and it says that we all now, there's no remembrance of these former things, right? If I actually was talking to someone the other day, we were trying to figure out this famous person, I don't even remember the name now, we were talking about it at the pool the other day, and we were trying to discuss who this person was. I couldn't remember if they were even a singer, we couldn't remember the name, how to pronounce it right, but the thing is, this is someone that a lot of people would have known, and they weren't that long ago. Right? And so the thing is, as we talk about this, just think now on the broad scale of all of the humans that have lived throughout history and think how little we know about any of them. Right? Some of them, there's so many that millions, billions, we don't even know, right? Don't even know their names. And so what he's saying is that's what we all have to recognize. We have to accept that death is a reality and that many will forget us in our lives. So, but the thing is, what I think is encouraging now as I shift here, though we finished this section, I do want to give us some encouragement. And I think what the author is doing is he wants us to face the reality of death. He wants us to accept death, accept the reality of hevel, right? That life is like a breath or is short, right? The brevity of life. But what he's saying is if you accept it, then you can recognize that you must seek fulfillment beyond the world that is under the sun. See, that's the point here, is that these things, it's a true reality for all of us under the sun, which means from the human perspective, looking up as we look under the sun, this is all we got. It's this cycle, right? It's the absurdity of life in a sense, right? It can be really depressing, right, as you think about it. But what he's saying here is that you actually can understand this, accept it, embrace it, and it actually will allow you to live well, to live life well. And how do we do that? Well, what we do is we, as I said, we seek fulfillment beyond the world under the sun. And so what we do is we look what is beyond or transcends the sun. And in fact, there's a quote by C.S. Lewis where he says, if I find in myself desires which nothing in this world can satisfy, the only logical explanation is that I was made for another world. So what he's saying is we have this desire in us that we don't like the concept of vanity or of hevel, of our lives being so short and brief and elusive. And so we struggle with this. And what C.S. Lewis says is this is revealing that there's something within us, something innate in the human condition that speaks that there's something beyond or something greater, something that is above the sun. And that is what the author is going to lead us through this book. He wants us to think about what more is there, what is above the sun, not as what is just under the sun. And what we're going to find, I think, is that God is the one who rules over the sun. God rules over the sun, and because of that, he actually is able to give us true newness. See, that's the thing, nothing new under the sun, but God who rules over the sun actually can offer us true, unique authenticity and novelties. We can actually experience new things. And I want to read for you just a couple verses on this in Isaiah 43:19. Behold, I will do a new thing. Now it shall spring forth, shall you not know it? I will even make a road in the wilderness and rivers in the desert. So this is speaking to how God is able to enter human history and actually enter and bring newness into our lives. And we obviously know that through the gospel message, we actually can become new creations, right? This is something that doesn't exist under the sun without God. But because there's someone above the sun that can actually intervene, we can actually see true newness being created. And in Revelation 21:5, it says, then he who sat on the throne, that is sitting above the sun, right? Who sits on the throne, he says, behold, I make all things new. And he said to me, write, for these words are true and faithful. So now what he's saying is the promise that we have through Christ, through what Christ did, through the cross, through his resurrection, and through his ascension, is there's a promise that he's actually going to make all things new. He's going to make it to where we can't even think or comprehend or utter the words of what is to come, right? We can't even truly fathom what eternity is going to be like, right? Whenever life isn't hevel, it's not brief, it's not like a breath, rather, it's ongoing, it's forever. You can't get rid of it, right? That's what eternal life, and Christ says, I'm going to offer you not only eternal life, but life abundantly. So that's the newness, the new type of life that he's going to offer us. And so the author is saying, look up, because in God, what you're going to do is you're going to find the only one who can truly satisfy our souls. He's going to be the one that actually satisfies our souls and where we can find true fulfillment. And I want to read just one other verse before I close. In Mark 8:36, Jesus says this, for what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? And what's interesting here is this is very similar to the question in verse 3 where it says, what does a man profit, right, if he works and toils for the earth? I think it's really similar. Jesus is saying the same question. What if you got the whole world? What if you worked and worked and got all the wealth and all the wisdom and all the pleasure like Solomon actually did? What's the point? Because if you lose your soul in the process, so what Jesus is saying is there's something that's transcendent of this monotonous, earthly, physical world. He's saying that you want to make sure that your soul is right, that your soul is satisfied. And so that is the choice that he's going to be laying on the table for us in this book. He's saying, do you want to think about just life under the sun? Or do you want to live a life that will actually bring satisfaction and fulfillment by thinking about what God or who God is and what he did and what he's calling us to? And so that's going to be the charge for the book, is to think not only about what's going on under the sun, but how that is then supposed to be related and then applied in our lives about what's happening above the sun.